then it's okay for me to record.
So to change it, I just do this.
Yeah.
This is actually
zoomed. Yes, yeah, so you're gonna mention that also. It's zoomed as far as I can get it today. Maybe the table moved. Okay, thank you guys all for coming to our day club. Sorry for the little hiccup at the beginning. Our first speaker is Ortiz Hunter. He's from the Ares Lab. And he'll be discussing genome-wide effects of the splicing inhibitor PLADB in yeast.
Thanks, Ali. Appreciate everyone for having me. First RNA club, so it's going to be interesting. Okay, so yes, like Ali said, my project is called Genome-Wide Effects of the Splicing Inhibitor PLADB in Yeast. And this was done led by me in collaboration with others in the lab, including Jason and Jen, and as well as people from outside of UCSC, which I'll talk about. Okay, so our story begins here at the early steps of splicing, in which a SNRP called U2 recognized a special sequence within an intron called the branch point early in splicing. And so here I'm showing a structure of U2 snRNA in green right here, and it is a complex with the intron in black. And the special part of this structure, The real star of this structure is, besides the RNA, of course, is this protein called SF3B1 in humans, in which it is wrapped around stabilizing this helix, bulging out the nucleophile of the first step of splicing, the branch point A. And this nucleophile is bulge into a special pocket within SF3B1, surrounded by these alpha helices, these pairs of alpha helices called heat repeats.
All right.
So many structures are coming out that include these class of splicing inhibitors, one of which is called PLADB. And now we know that PLADB actually competes for the same pocket as the branch point that we see in human SF3B1. So here's another structure. It's actually, this is a crystal structure from 2018. And on the left, I'm showing you SF3B1 in purple in complex with the branch point A, the bulged out branch point A in that U2 snRNA intron helix, and that's shown here. And then on the left, see that this small molecule called PLADB binds in the same pocket as the branch point A, wrapped around these heat repeats 15 and 16, and a little bit of 17 as well. And so that has really led to this model in which upon entering the splice zone, SF3B1 is open conformation where the hinge is that previous slide, and in the presence of PLADB keeps it open, leading to splicing inhibition. Whereas in the absence of PLADB, SF3B1 is able to wrap around stabilizing the U2 intron helix, bulging the BPA into that pocket. And so that leads us to one of the main drivers of this project. And it's in the question, how does PLADB, the small molecule, affect splicing in yeast? So before we can answer that, we have to really understand why we would want to use yeast to answer this question. And so we know that yeast splicing is very similar to mammalian splicing or human splicing. Lots of conserved proteins, including the star of the show, which is H155, the homolog of SF3B1. Yeast has a low number of introns compared to humans, so about 270 introns, and most of which have one, maybe two introns per gene. There's some alternative splicing in yeast, but overall, in yeast, we have a simpler splicing model to test this question. And it's also, I should also emphasize that normal yeast or wild type yeast is not actually sensitive to PLADB. And so how are we gonna make yeast sensitive to this drug? So what I did was I used CRISPR-Cas9 to change some residues starting in the genome. And so what I did was swap out the yeast residues in this pocket, yeast 15 and 16, for the human counterpart. And so what I'm showing here is an amino acid alignment between, at the top is yeast, the yeast sequence in this pocket, and the bottom is the human sequence. And you can see most of it is conserved, but sprinkled in this pocket are little differences. And so what I did with CRISPR is essentially made whatever differences were in yeast, made the new one. And then here's one of the mutants that we got, and we decided to call it Y2H2. It's essentially humanized in this area. And so Y2H2 essentially stands for yeast to human, CRISPR colony 2. So this is the strain that I'm going to be using for subsequent experiments. Okay, so now that we made the construct, we want to test to see if the protein from this gene is actually working, from this mutant gene is actually working. So turns out that it does work. And so what I did was I did a simple growth assay doing a 10 times dilution spot going down. I tested at three temperatures, 18, 30, and 37. And you can see Y2H2, our humanized mutant, grows comparably to wild type. So that's a good sign so far. In addition, to make sure this protein is working and doing its job further, I attached a C-terminal GFP tag to it. And so here's your Hutch-155 right here. I attached GFP to the C-terminus and did a Western blot with antibodies against GFP. And so here's that, and here's wild type GFP right here. You see it, Y2H2 GFP, we also see it. Here's a negative control without the tag, without the GFP tag. We do not see it. And then the spurt lane is the antibody control to make sure the antibody is working. So we conclude that this protein, this mutant protein is working. But now we want to see if we actually get inhibition by this drug. All right, so one of the first experiments to test inhibition I did was a time course against a gene in yeast called MAD-A1. And so this gene has a high transcription rate and a high decay rate. And so we use this gene specifically to test instantaneous inhibition. And so what I have here is a time course. This side is DMSO, which is what the drug is dissolved in. And on the right, we have PB. And we have time from 0 to 8 minutes on both sides. And you can see in DMSO control, you get splicing. This is just the spawn band. Let me step back a little bit and talk about the products. We use two oligos for an RT-PCR that gives an unspliced product in this first intron. This gene has two introns. An unspliced product, and if splicing is happening, we'll get a shorter product that migrates farther down the gel. So in DMSO control, you get splicing happening at all time points. In the plat B, when we add drug, we see that we get splicing at first at 0 minutes. And then within 1 to 4 minutes, we can start to see that unspliced product appear. So indicating that splicing is happening within minutes. And not only that, it gets worse with time. So from 4 to 8 minutes, you see a difference in this intensity, the band in that intensity, which tells us that within 8 minutes, its inhibition is really strong. All right, next. Okay, so in addition to the time course that we did, we also did a in vitro study to test inhibition. We're using the same cells, and this was done by Jason in the lab. So if we focus on the left panel here, this is a splicing gel in which our RNAs are spliced in vitro, and we have at the top the increasing concentration of plat B, so it's a titration. And so you can see as you increase the concentration of plat B, the inhibitor, you see decrease in splicing intermediates,
which suggests splicing inhibition.
And we see something similar when we do a complex gel. And so this is a gel that's where we're running complex spliceosome complexes, and this is the pre-spliceosome or the A complex, and you can see that disappearing as you increase in drugs. And this suggests that not only that you get inhibition, but the drug is most likely inhibiting in the pre-spliceosome as opposed to the commenda complex, which is earlier.
All right.
And so taking it a step further, we wanted to see the co-transcriptional effects of PLAD-B on splicing. And so for this experiment, we collaborated with Carla Neugebauer at Yale to do an experiment called single molecule intron tracking. And this tests
splicing co-transcriptional.
And so we can capture the nascent RNAs coming off the gene as polymerase rides down the gene. And if we attach a 3' linker, a 3' end, we can measure the fraction splice versus pole 2 position. And so we did this for 4 libraries, wild type with PLAD-B, humanized and humanized with PLAD-B at 5 micromolar. And so
the results
are shown here. And it's a little overwhelming, so please forgive me, but essentially we have every position of pole 2 collapse into one. And so on the x-axis is all of the intron genes we tested. And so what we're comparing is, for example, if we look at the very left side, is this gene without PLAD-B and then the same gene with PLAD-B. And you can see the fraction splice goes down when you add PLAD-B. So we see that, for example, here, and here's another example. We see it even more here. And so the interesting about this experiment, what came out of it was that different genes are affected differently. And we have a question there.
Okay, so the red sticks are showing like
the mean? The mean, yes. So I'm looking at the mean, comparing the means here. And so the interesting thing is that each gene is affected by the drug differently. And so even if you look at this gene right here, DBP1, you see barely an effect of inhibition.
Yes.
So yes, we did. So I'm not showing that here. We did see a few genes that are affected by wild type, but that's, we want to review that just to make sure. Because I also have some contradicting evidence to say that. All right, so taking it even further, we decided to do another sequencing experiment in which we take our humanized yeast and delete a gene called UPF1. And UPF1 is a gene within NMD, the NMD complex, and it degrades RNAs with nonsense mutations, so stop codons. And so deleting this gene allows those enrichment of those RNAs that would be degraded, and we can capture them in the RNA-seq pipeline. So what we did was incubate yeast with or without drug, with or without PLAD-B specifically, or PLAD-B and this other drug, which I'll talk about in a minute. So with or without drug, extract the RNA and prepare for libraries. And then we did Illumina sequencing and got back 105 to 180. Million reads per sample. I'm going to show you today is a subset of those reads at 10 million for this analysis. So we did 6 duplicate libraries, wild type without drug, wild type with PLAD-B, humanized without PLAD-B, humanized at a high concentration of PLAD-B, humanized at a low concentration of PLAD-B, and humanized for another splicing inhibitor called thalassadin A.
And so
this is a UCSC genome browser track showing all the libraries for this MAT-A1 gene that I talked about earlier in the time course experiment. And you can see in both wild type and the humanized without drug, you see splicing is happening at both of these introns right here. When you add drug, low concentration of drug, we see an enrichment of reads within the intron, suggesting inhibition. You can get an even exacerbated effect if you increase the concentration of PLAD-B. And we get a similar result for another drug that binds in the same pocket as PLAD-B and the branch point. And here's another gene, just to emphasize the differences in gene or drug effects with different genes. Here's the same read or the same libraries. And we see some resistance when we get into the PLAD-B with humanized. So we see a low amount of reads in this intron for this gene. And so there's a different effect with different genes. And so we really want to understand why that is. All right. So moving along, I wanted to look at, so in this, I want to look at differential gene expression, just comparing DMSO to 5-micromolar PLAD-B in Y2H2 cells. And in this volcano plot, we have a bunch of genes that are show a decrease in expression on this side, and some genes, but not as much, showing an increase in expression. And if you look closely, we see that most of these genes are ribosomal genes. And it actually turns out that most of the introns in yeast are genes that are ribosomal and code for ribosomal proteins. So that kind of makes sense. If you add drug, you get a slight decrease in expression for these intron-containing genes. What was even more interesting was this increase. So I kind of looked into it a little bit, and we see some snow RNAs here. And so snow RNAs are responsible for modifying ribosomal RNAs and some heat shock protein factors as well that are increasing expression. And so, yes, we conclude that the intron-containing genes are decreasing expression, and we get other genes increasing expression. And so with when you add PLAD-B. So yeah.
Yes. Any of the snow RNAs derived from introns, could that explain why they're...
Absolutely. So yes, actually, I would say a lot of the snow RNAs in yeast are within introns. So
those two definitely are.
Yeah.
Those two that you have there are introns.
So yeah.
It says that there's less expression of ribosomal genes. Is that, I guess, is that mRNA or is that pre-mRNA? Are you looking at spliced RNAs with that? Or I'm kind of trying to understand why we're having the intron still there plus a decrease in expression, which I would assume is a decrease in transcription. But maybe.
So if I understand your question, you want to know why these ribosomal protein genes, which have introns, are they mRNAs and not ribosomal RNAs?
No, is it when you say that the gene expression is down,
yeah,
are you talking about expression of the spliced messenger RNA or the overall transcript, which could be both spliced and messenger?
So I believe splice. Because we're adding the overall expression of splicing RNAs, because we're comparing DMSO to PLAD-B. Does that make sense?
So you're only comparing the
splice?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so my future directions have been guided by a series of questions, one of which is the question that I've been alluding to this whole time, which is how is splicing affected by this inhibitor, PLAD-B, as well as other inhibitors. So I gave you a sneak peek into another inhibitor called thylacine A, but there are others, carboxydiene, splicosidin A. So we want to also understand what the effects of those inhibitors are. Why are genes affected by PLAD-B differently? And I have a few guesses. One is the intron structure, this intron secondary structure could have some involvement, as well as how fast the polymerase is moving across the gene, so the transcription rate. These things could be different per gene, and so that could be one explanation, but further experiments gotta be done. And then one of the more interesting questions to me is, how is PLADB or other drugs affect branch point usage, given that this drug is binding in the same pocket that is normally reserved for the branch point A? And so one of the things that we're working on, or I'm working on, is doing another RNA-seq experiment in which we delete a gene called DBR1, which is involved in cleaving the 2'-5' linkage that is a part of the lariat product at the end of splicing. So if you delete this gene, you get an enrichment of lariats, and then we can sequence across the junction and look at and try to find alternative branch points in the presence or in the absence of drug. Another experiment we can do is we've been developing a branch point, dual branch point reporter, and that's shown over here. And this is a ACT1 gene, ACT1 intron, that has two branch points because we made it that way. And each branch point is associated with a different 3' splice site. So this one, or this branch point and this one. And so depending on which branch point the splice zone chooses, we get a different RNA species that we can resolve on the gel. So that's another way of getting at how the drug affects branch point usage.
To be determined.
And so with that, I want to acknowledge members of the Ares Lab, including Manny, Jason, and Jan. Jason did the in vitro work that I talked about, and Jan worked with the Neugebauer Lab at Yale to work on SMNT. Saul and JP have been and are doing the RNA-seq analysis. I want to thank some people at Illumina, including Sky and Morgan, who actually did the sequencing for the UPF1 deleted mutants. And then Tara and Carla at Yale for SMNT. Jasper Ryan from Berkeley gave us a strain that we used throughout this whole project. And then I also want to thank Angela Brooks for teaching me how to do RNA-seq analysis in this class, BME 237. It's a great class. I recommend it. And then Melissa for donating the non-PLADB drug, Thylacin A, that we used in RNA-seq. So thank you.
For the other genes that you see down regulation, are they all intact? Or do you see some things that are going down because they're affecting
the the differential analysis, are all the decreased expression all intron containing? So most of them, I think, are, and I try to highlight some of them in that graph. But there are probably a few that are not, that have no introns, and they're just decreased because of the drug. Could be because of some type of stress mechanism that's at play. So I don't believe they're all intron containing, but most of them I think are.
And do you see any upregulation of components in the splice zone? I'm interested if there's kind of feedback in the
cell. Yeah. I was thinking about that as well. So I haven't seen anything yet because this is still new data, but one of the, like, for example, the snRNA genes could be an example of something that goes up in response to there being less spliceosome available because this drug is just taking all of the spliceosomes. So, yeah.
Nick. So just to be clear, you mentioned in your volcanoes a lot.
Yeah.
The differential expression is comparing splice form to unspliced form. Correct? Or it was just general expression level of the transcript.
General expression level, yes. Exactly.
Gotcha. So yeah. SNO RNA genes, which are contained in introns,
yeah,
would be accumulating because they're not being spliced out, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's definitely a mechanism that I can see.
I mean, assuming that splicing is how they're born, right?
Yeah, it's more complicated.
Okay. It's an interesting question, though.
It is an interesting question. Yeah.
I didn't think about this. I think you have to beat them twice to get the snow RNA.
I don't think that's necessarily the case, but it's not really that well studied to be able to say that a single transcript can give rise to both the messenger RNA and the snow RNA. But what you saw in your volcano plot, those two that were you marked are definitely intronic. There's maybe 10 intronic of snow RNA. So those are two of them. One's a ribosomal protein gene, and the other's maybe it's also a ribosomal protein. But that seems like evidence that those, although I have to say, actually, the way this library is done, the sizes of the snow RNAs are very close to the edge in terms of being incorporated into the library routinely. And so I wouldn't, you'd want to validate this result by a direct method of some kind before getting very excited about it. And so it's possible that they're going up because there's now more unspliced RNA for them to be processed down with.
Question.
The Mendoza, you had Jason Wren, yeah. Higher levels of lab B was the lines were dimmer. On the top there?
This, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so these, sorry, go ahead.
You know what? Why on the right side of that, at like 1.0, you know,
it was the Yeah, so the question is, why are these getting dimmer? Right.
Yeah.
So this is plot B concentration and it's getting higher. And so as concentration of this inhibitor gets higher, we see the amount of splicing intermediates. So these are splicing intermediates. So we're measuring splicing. We see it decrease. So that makes sense because splicing is being inhibited. Yeah.
I think it's just inhibition.
That's a good question that I haven't tested yet. It could be plot B specifically could be in reversibly, can come off the splice zone. Other drugs that bind this pocket, for example, splicesin A actually has been shown by crystal structure to bind covalently to the splice zone, so probably less so. I heard someone.
Like my eyes can kind of guess an IC50 for inhibition, it's almost identical to human splicing.
Absolutely.
So it is, even that, I mean, you've humanized the pocket enough that it's like even finding it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Ortiz.
Thanks a lot, Laura.
All right.
Recorded by her.
Okay, yeah, of course.
So, Ali, you already introduced me, but I'm Marcus. And we're talking about pretty much my trials in getting direct RNA-seq with Nanopore to work for mRNA decay, and then more specifically for nonsense mediated decay, which I'll introduce in a second here. And it doesn't work. Classic.
No, it's just working.
Yeah, cool. I probably don't need a central dogma slide, but I want to focus in on one particular thing. Mutations can arise in DNA or during the transcription of RNA that will introduce early stop codons, also known as nonsense mutations. Ortiz also introduced this, which is great. And this will lead to a shorter, truncated version of the protein getting produced. This could potentially be totally fine or vary all the way up to dominant, negative, and detrimental for the cell. And this is pretty important. Around 11% of disease-causing mutations are identified as this kind of like early stop codon lesion. And to this end, eukaryotes have the system of NMD, which targets these RNAs and destroys them before they can produce too much of this truncated protein. It's kind of a whole field on its own. It's there's a lot going on here, but what I'm really interested in, how is this degradation elicited by the NMD system rather than anything to do with like targeting and that kind of thing? And so right now in the field, there's, or most literature is settled on a model with two redundant forms of decay. One being a cleavage by an endonuclease, SMUG6, and the other being recruitment of exonucleases, specifically deadenylases, by SMUGs5 and 7. But there's some issues with this model. Some of the oldest genetic evidence in our field kind of questions whether this can really function in this way. For example, if we knock out SMUG6 or 5 or 7, all NMD function is completely knocked out. And this indicates that these two pathways, that these two pathways aren't actually independent and redundant with one another. Another is that the implication of the deadenylases, the SMUG5-7 side of this, lacks any functional evidence or any direct evidence that really ties deadenylases into this pathway. And the last is that some of the more recent studies of this pathway have been unable to assess both of these forms of degradation simultaneously. For example, we've used RiboSeq in our lab several times to look at this cleavage event by SMUG6. We can really get a good picture of that, but we miss out on any information about the tail or the rest of the mRNA. On the other side, something like TailSeq is able to capture information about the poly A tail, but it misses out on the rest of the mRNA, such as a cleavage event that might have happened. For this reason, I'm going to propose two models, and then I'm hoping to try and test them with my PhD and be able to figure out really how this degradation is happening after it's targeted by NMD. So one model is kind of just crushing those two models, or that two arms of the degradation pathway into one. The idea here being that SMUG5 and 7 recruit the adenylases and promote the endonucleotic cleavage by SMUG6. This would align pretty well with the genetic evidence, but still leaves the question of if the adenylation is even part of this. The alternative model would be that just normal RNA turnover is recruiting these deadenylases. They're variably shortening these mRNA tails. And then eventually it gets targeted by NMD. SMUG5, 7, and 6 act together to elicit this cleavage and lead to this mRNA getting destroyed. Like I was saying earlier, kind of previous tools have been unable to differentiate these kinds of models. I want to try and use nanopore because the long reads with direct RNA-seq will allow me to span both putative degradation sites from the potential cut near the early stop codon all the way out to the poly A tail. My hope here would be that with nanopore information and with tail and cleavage information simultaneously on even single molecules, I'll be able to really tell if polyadenylation is part of this pathway and what the degradation of NMD targets looks like. And so that's what I'm pretty much going to be talking about. I told you why I want to use nanopore. I didn't tell you why I need to optimize it. That's what I'll talk about right now. This is the regular nanopore protocol. So I'll go through it quickly, and I'm going to eventually talk about how I'm changing parts of it. So we run a poly selection. That way we get our mRNA species. We will leg it on this reverse transcription adapter. So the splint adapter, so it's really going to be at the very 3' end of whatever tail is there. We're going to run reverse transcription and attach a motor protein. This reverse transcription is really only for stabilizing the mRNA, and it's also for minimizing any secondary structure that might be a problem for that motor protein. Then when we're sequencing, that motor protein is going to pull this whole mRNA through the nanopore, and the voltages of those k-mers are what is going to be called to give us our sequencing that we're going to get. So three issues with this. One big one is that I'm interested in poly A tails, if I'm selecting for foliate tails, I'm going to always skew what the like biological truth is. So this is a big problem for the biological questions that I'm actually asking. The second, also foliate related, is that this splint adapter that I was talking about before requires a fairly short tail to be able to anneal and ligate to. Once again, if something's completely deadenylated, I might not be able to capture it with this. And then finally, as a RNA species is being sequenced, we lose like 10 to 15, sometimes more, nucleotides of information on the very 5' end of the read. And this is really important if I want to be able to get single nucleotide precision on that cleavage event I was talking about earlier. And so in order to do this, I need to try and solve some of these issues. And that's what I've been up to pretty much. So same protocol. After talking with Matane and Mark Agassin a bit, we realized that we should just omit foliate selection. And that hopefully our splint adapter is going to allow us to still select for mRNAs at a much less biased level, and we'll still be able to get a sequenced and happy library. So I've been running this. I have several libraries, biological replicates with and without foliate selection. I've been working to try and figure out if I can really trust just skipping foliate selection completely. I don't want to take something out of the box and just assume it's going to work. And that's what we're trying to do and validate all of this technique. So one of the big things that people do to validate nanopore runs is looking at the distribution of read lengths. If you run tanks, then usually you'll have really short reads, and kind of vice versa, longer reads usually indicates a better run. And so this is four distributions of two poly-A selected and then two libraries where just completely skipped selection. Maybe hard to tell what there's four, they're basically like superimposed on top of each other. And so I'm pretty confident that we're getting really consistent read length, which is already a good sign. If now we look at how many reads per gene, so reads per million out of gene we're getting, we can see for the most part, we have a really nice diagonal here. And every point on here is a gene. And you know, y-axis is our unselected library, x-axis is our poly-A selected. And I'm pretty confident that for the most part, most genes are showing similar expression. It's really differential capture, but similar expression with or without foliate selection. The big caveat here is that it's not 100%. There are a couple off diagonal genes here, and that really interested us. I wanted to be sure that those genes were consistently the same ones being captured or being differentially captured between my different libraries. And so I kind of compressed a lot of information on this. I'm sorry. Hopefully we can walk through it. On one axis, we have the fold chains. So the relative ratio of selected and unselected libraries or reads in a single library for one of my biological samples. So something on our far left is going to be really well sequenced in our unselected, and something on the far right is really well sequenced in our selected library. Now, Y, basically the same thing, but with a different biological sample. So what's interesting here is that we have our main population up here, and then we have some kind of genes that are consistently better sequenced in our unselected libraries. So it seems like they're getting lost when we run foliate selection. The question remains as to what's causing the differential capture of these genes, and if it is an issue for all of my runs, if I should be worried about it, and so forth. Yeah, of course. Yes, right now. So we jumped around a lot trying to figure out what this would be. We kind of, in hindsight, the obvious answer is that the tails are different. And what we realized is when we look at poly-A tails, so this is the mean tail length for an unselected library on the Y and a selected library on the X. And we can see this dashed line is the diagonal where the tail length would be equal across two libraries. We can see that we're almost exclusively below the diagonal, indicating that we're selecting for longer and longer tail lengths whenever we run poly-A selection. Kind of obvious, but good to check. I picked out two example genes for us here. One is this blue one. And this is the distribution of tail lengths for reads that map to this gene. We can see that our unselected and our selected distributions are basically identical. This is encouraging for this gene, but of course, there are a bunch of genes that are not on the diagram. If we look at one of those, it starts to get interesting. We can see that we have this main population that we're able to capture in both selected and unselected libraries. But there's this subpopulation of really short genes, or really short tail lengths mapping to this gene that are completely missed out on when we run poly-A selection. And this is already kind of worrying, and we were curious as to if this might be able to describe that differential capture we were seeing before.
Have you?
Yeah.
Do any of your dots correspond to genes naturally occurring NMD target, like RPL12? You might expect, if you know that there's some form of them that take away NMD.
So oh, sure. They're your genes in my size. Yeah. I haven't quite dug through the NMD targets in this list.
No, that's fine. Yeah. I was wondering, because I'm wondering where those might be.
Yeah, I think RPL7A, there has one isoform that's an NMD target. And I'm pretty sure I had a weird poly-A tail distribution. I didn't include any of those on here. It'd be good to, though. Yeah. Yes.
Are these Y scales something the same?
Exactly the same. Sorry.
So this one on the right.
It does have shorter tails.
Darn short.
Yep.
Sorry, the one on the left.
Yep.
Quite short. And yet they're being selected well in both. The other one has more longer ones.
Yes.
But the short ones aren't.
Yeah.
Is it a competition? Or is it?
So,
is there a minimal length that looks like 40?
Yes. There is a minimal length that I've seen that's kind of around 25 to 50, it depends on the gene that you're looking at. But if you look across all of them, our mean tail length minimum is 40. But they're, so over here, we can see a couple of reads that are real close to zero. I should have white axes, sorry. Real close to zero. But there's also some noise in this technique of pulling poly-A tails. So I'm not really sure if those are true zero tails or not. If they were really completely tailless, they wouldn't have made it into the library, like I was describing before. Yeah, so there does seem to be some selection. This thing that you pointed out is definitely true and is very interesting. I think this has more to do with that so much of the population of genes exists in this very short tail length. And there are often well-expressed genes that look like this. What ends up happening is that even though maybe I'm getting less of them in my selected library, they're still so highly expressed that they're showing up pretty often. And while oftentimes, these kind of crazy ones have some, they're not quite as highly expressed genes. There's some more resident mRNAs that seem to have long life, a long life cycle in this cell. But I wanted to try and use this information to describe that differential expression we were talking about earlier. And I wanted to make sure it was consistent across two biological replicates. This is another plot where I'm crushing a lot of information. There's gonna be more information, hang in there. And so what we're looking at is the difference in the poly-A selected versus the unselected tail lengths, right? So our two example genes from before, when we look at their mean tail lengths, these black lines. What we're doing here for our blue on the left, we have a point at 0, 0, and that's because the mean tail length is completely consistent between the two techniques. On our far right, one of our most extreme genes out here, we can see this very dramatic tail length difference around 40. And so this is already indicating that there seems to be fairly consistent variable tails across multiple biological replicates. Not super consistent, this is kind of a blob, but we're mostly going to be interested in our extreme cases that are diverging away from the main population. Sorry for the colorblind. We're mostly going to look at the most extreme, the red and the dark blue on the bottom. And then there's just a scale in between. So I wanted to take this color scale that we produced and use this to try and see if it describes our differential expression. Same plot as before, nothing different happening. If we take our scale we produced here, we'll use that to describe what's happening on our differential expression plot. It seems like, I know there's so much information on this plot, but it seems like a lot of our red genes are kind of in this lower quadrant. A lot of our darker blue genes are really tight in the center of this main population, and the rest in the middle is kind of a wash. But this seems like there is a, these two things are kind of aligning with one another, differential expression and our poly A tail changes. This might be kind of, maybe not causative, but they're definitely related. This is a lot of information. If we try and zoom into one of these axes and minimize some of it, it's gonna look like more information, but I promise it's not. If we look at one of these axes and look at the distributions of each of these groups that we call based on their tail lengths, we can see that they're basically lined up from left to right the way with the color scale. If we just look at our most extreme case, our really variable tail lengths, we compare that to the rest of the population, we can tell that there's definitely a left shift here, of course, that indicates that these genes are constantly getting better sequence in our unselected libraries. This is a statistically significant difference between these two groups. And we're pretty confident that this might describe what's happening with our differential expression between a fully selected and unselected library. The question still remains, is this variability coming from the poly selection runs or my unselected runs? The thought has always been that the unselected runs are more minimally processed, so there should be less variability coming in there. But of course, we always have to ask this question. But I had technical replicates of the same biological sample with two poly A selections and two total RNA runs, so poly A selection for those ones. And we can see, we take our same grouping of genes, and this time we're actually comparing between two poly A selected libraries. They are again differentially captured across two technical replicates. And so this, if I was actually running a biologically relevant experiment, this would look like differential expression or noise within my technical replicates, my libraries. And this is a significant difference. These genes are consistently being separated away from the main population. If we look at our unselected libraries, we just skipped poly A selection, ran two replicates. We can see that we're much closer to the main population, and then this is no longer a significant difference between the two. And so this is providing some confidence that by omitting poly A selection, we're able to have a more consistent gene expression profile for multiple technical replicates, and that we're not getting kind of this, what looks like noise coming out of our technical replicates with poly A selection. This was really encouraging. I was super excited. I wanted to make sure I wasn't just doing something weird with my hands in lab. So I grabbed two-year-old data, pre-COVID data, that they also did multiple technical replicates of poly A selected libraries. I used our same gene group as before. And we can see for their data too, our most extreme group is separated away from the main population. And so basically from run to run, we're getting variability between poly A selection. This is manifesting as what looks like differential expression. It's really just differential capture, right? And by omitting the selection, we are minimizing this variability, at least for nanopore direct RNA-seq. This is really exciting and kind of worrying. If I was doing a biological technique where I had minimal replicates, some of this noise might be looking like actually statistically significant changes in my sequencing. So that's all for super crazy plots. Thank you for bearing with me. yes, of course.
So you're saying that there's a set of genes that show variable selection, and then there's a lot of genes that don't.
There are a lot of genes that are more consistently captured from run to run. And I think this set of genes, these genes have very very wide distribution of their tail lengths. And so depending on how well your poly A selection works, you either catch a lot of it or a very minimal amount. That's been my best explanation so far. I think if I could fix poly A selection, I could make a lot of money. So maybe next time. But either way, pretty much from here on out, I'm exclusively running total RNA runs, no poly A selection for my direct RNA-seq. Until the last slide, but whatever. So we've been really focused on this side of the equation, barely even talking about MD so far, except for Al's Good question. From now on, I'm a little more focused on NMD. I'm more confident in what I'm doing with Fourier selection or what I'm not doing with Fourier selection. And so right now we're gonna look at this 5' end and try and see if we can better capture evidence of this cleavage happening in our direct RNA sequencing libraries. Up until a couple months ago, this was a huge problem, like I described before, for direct RNA-seq. Thankfully, someone solved this problem for me, Fadia Ibrahim out of Philadelphia. So this is the regular protocol. They released this paper, TerraSeq, true end-to-end sequencing of native RNA molecules. And the change they made, in hindsight, is pretty simple. They used a 5' adapter ligation, and so that when we eventually sequence this species, we're losing out on some of the information, the 5' end information from our adapter, which we don't really care about. And we're able to retain single nucleotide precision of our original mRNA end. This is really exciting for being able to identify where that cleavage is happening. Right, so this is great for being able to identify where SMUNK6 cut. Yes, SMUNK6 cuts. Okay, sorry. Also, additionally exciting, we can use specific ligation chemistry here to target the 5' monophosphate that's left by our endonuclease SMUNK6. Super exciting. Kind of a downside is that the main 5' to 3' exonuclease, XRN1, is also going to leave a 5' monophosphate. So that's just going to completely muck up any signal that I might get from SMUNK6. So we knocked it down with RNAi. The additional advantage of knocking it down with RNAi, besides just getting rid of some of that noise, is that we're also going to better stabilize this species. Because normally, once that cut happens and there's no longer a cap to protect that, that mRNA is going to get destroyed pretty quickly. So I have two libraries with this. I have some preliminary data. I'm still working with kind of global analysis and some statistics to back up what I'm seeing, but I have one really cool gene that was exciting. We're gonna look at UBL1. And the important part here is that it has two isoforms, right? Our top isoform, or bottom first, our bottom isoform here is NMD insensitive is normally expressed in our C. elegans worms. Our top isoform has a 3' splice site change that introduces a frame shift and leads to the introduction of an early stop codon. So this top isoform is an NMD target. And when we just do regular sequencing, wild type with XRN1 knocked down, we can see that for the most part, we only see the non-NMD site sensitive isoform showing up in our library. And this makes sense because the NMD sensitive one, if it is expressed, is getting destroyed before we can sequence it. I didn't explain. These are reads, of course. The light blue is maps. All of the points are errors introduced by direct RNA-seq. Don't use direct RNA-seq if you want to call SNPs. And then our dark blue is introns. We have some soft clipping on the end here, which is likely from the splice leader in C. elegans, and some bright green, which is our poly-A tail. If we knock out NMD with a SMUG6 catalytic mutant, so NMD is completely broken in these, we can suddenly see, I know it might be hard to see, that our NMD sensitive isoform is now being expressed, or not being expressed, but showing up in our sequencing library. And we're able to capture it and happily sequence it. If it's hard to see in the back, you can tell by this coverage map that all of a sudden we're using that later 3' splice. But I am showing you guys this because the exciting part is the TerraSeq and being able to capture our adapted species. So here in pink now, these two runs are from the same library, and in silico we identified which reads had an adapter. We tagged those reads and we cut off that adapter. And so we can really trust location of the 5' end of all of these reads. And we can see that for the most part, all of these reads, or their 5' ends, are downstream of our stop codon. We think what's happening here is they're being cut by SMUG6, like I've pictured, but our RNAi, of course, wasn't complete. We have some XRN1 floating around still, and it's chewing back these reads, leading to this kind of shorter degradation intermediate that we're capturing. Interestingly, we do also see some full-length or almost full-length species. We think these are normal RNA turnover of the non-NMD sensitive isoform. We can see that they're exclusively non-NMD sensitive isoform, and that it looks like they were just decapped and they're about to get degraded by XRM1 if there was enough around. You might have also noticed that in our SMUG6, our NMD mutant, we don't get any of these degradation intermediates. This is kind of a good sign because it seems like NMD is broken, so we're not getting these cut and chewed back mRNA species. But also, I think part of what's happening here is sequencing depth issues, potentially ligation or prep-to-prep ligation differences, and potentially prep-to-prep depth issues. Nonetheless, this is already really exciting. It seems like I'm already capturing my subspecies here that we talked about earlier. I can see maybe not all the way up to the stop codon, but pretty close. And we can also start to see some poly-A tails. I really want to do a much more in-depth analysis before I can kind of call it one way or the other. But this is exciting. I can capture these downstream degradation intermediates. And I think with a little more analysis, I'll be able to confidently say kind of what's going on with poly-A tails. The one downside right now is that I still can't sequence completely tailless mRNA species. So if something was completely deadenylated, which don't actually show up here, it would never show up in my sequencing libraries. So there could be a subpopulation that I'm totally missing out on that is important towards capturing this whole picture, right? And I don't actually have any preliminary data for this, but I want to be able to sequence tailless mRNA species. Would have been a huge issue in the past, but Badia Ibrahim saves the day again. TerraSeq, they also published a variation to capture tailless mRNAs. This is regular nanopore protocol, but like I was talking about, if we have a very short tail or non-existent tail, we won't be able to anneal to our splint ligation adapter, and we won't be able to ligate to it. And we will never sequence it, of course. The change they made is pretty much the same change they made on the other side. They are using a ligation to the 3' end to attach a custom adapter. And then from there, it's pretty much the regular nanopore protocol, and we're able to sequence completely tailless mRNA species. This is super exciting. I kind of wish I knew about it before I did the whole long trek into the poly-A stuff, but that was also really interesting, so I'm happy with it. The only downside is that if I don't do any kind of ribodepletion, I'm going to almost exclusively sequence ribosomal RNAs, which could be fun, but not really for my biological questions. And so I'm going to have to get my ribodepletion, because we've had runs of it in the past. I need to get it up to the amount where I can produce enough raw RNA for nanopore direct RNA-seq, so RNA hungry. That is all I have. I really appreciate everyone being here and listening. I'd be happy to take more questions or comments. I want to publish the poly-A stuff soon, so if there's comments about how that story looks, I'd also be happy to hear that. I've got a lot of help from a lot of people. Thank you all. Happy to take questions. Oh, yeah, right. Are there on here?
There's none on the chat.
Okay. Yes.
So for the poly-A, Sergio Barberin was a student in my lab in, probably 14 or 15 years ago, using a DNA microarrays to study alternative splicing. He showed this cool observation, which is that some of the really just obvious NMD-induced isoform changes, if you could, isoforms that were degraded rapidly, that if you did, like, for example, RT-PCR with the gene specifically was primary to look at alternative splicing, you'd see obvious differences in NMD targets, they'd be disappearing. But if we did poly-A selection first, that change would be considered really dramatic, sort of subtle. You thought about it for a while, and then what Sergio kind of figured out through serial rounds of poly-A selection is that it kind of came up with this idea that you leave the nucleus with a full-length poly tail, but you're not going to be around very long because you're going to be destroyed by and in B. Then if you do, and if you compare that to another isoform that's going to be around for a while, and over time, its poly A tail slowly lessens, that by doing any kind of poly A selection, you really do enrich for the longer poly A tails on the end of B isoform.
So it seems like we're capturing earlier stage mRNAs. They're just getting exported.
Right. And so it makes perfect sense to get away from that. I'm wondering if one way to do this might be like, instead of sequencing everything to focus on one gene that you want to show anyway, is if you could do like a splinted, like do CRISPR, an RNA-based CRISPR cleavage or a hammerhead cleavage at a specific point, and then do near the poly A tail, and then do a splinted ligation to make an RNA adapter that's specific for that gene that would work with this, and then just create a small nanopore library for a single
targeted,
and then analyze it that way. I don't know if it worked for microRNA. I'm wondering if it might work for more. You could then make a nanopore library, just the mRNA.
I would actually talk to Chad and maybe you about that later. That sounds really exciting.
Mark Akerson raised his hand.
Marcus, that was a great talk. It's gratifying to see real RNA biologists using the technology. One point I wanted to make, and it may be useful to you. The assumption early on was that you had to do RT to allow for efficient translocation and capture and so forth. And we've tested that on both ribosomal RNAs and tRNAs. And there's a slight hit if you don't do RT. You still get about 80% yield. And it doesn't seem to, the RNAs, at least ribosomal RNA, tRNA, don't get stuck. And so whatever the helicase that kind of motors it through seems to overcome any sort of physical barriers, at least for the RNAs we work with. So you may not have to do the RT unless you need it for TerraSeq. And I don't know that technology. It sounds pretty terrific.
Yeah, TerraSeq is also indifferent to the RT step. So I could probably drop it.
Yeah, it may actually, and the RT step may reduce the quality of your data. So give it a try.
Definitely worth trying. I actually haven't tried to run any libraries without that RT. Mm-hmm. I'm scared to add too many variables. Thank you.
Is there a way that is that still a model, and could you use that as a way to reach for things that are being NMD, right? Only things that
So the things that are still associated with nuclear four?
Yep.
I haven't heard anything that doesn't say that's the running model. But that would be a great way to try and reach for very early translation steps, then potentially looking for those kinds of,
Because isn't the idea that this is happening in that person? What's that model? What's the state of that model that you can only really get them to be in that frame and around and after that information is lost?
I think we can get NMD and other than the frame around. And I think when the plot, I'm not really sure what to make the Pioneer model, because I was sort of raised on that one as well, but I'm not sure how you would know that definitively versus.
I mean, there's a canon, and it mostly does. Is it still the thought that maybe still mostly does happen, right? But again, you could at least.
That's not fair to me, because of I think of the foundation of that field being on a couple of reporters, and then how the claim of the most comes out of that.
But they use different the nuclear cap binding protein participating.
Yeah. So you could maybe.
Yeah, I want intermediate.
You select for the cap binding. And the arc.
Yeah, but
okay, if it's. Yeah, if it's still holding onto the polyethylene tail, that'd be fine. Yeah, I'm definitely interested in that free, this guy, our free prime degradation intermediate. I could potentially capture somewhat similar information. I'd kind of miss out on the polyethylene tail. If I look at the 5' degradation intermediate plus cleavage, both are definitely interesting. I've dug myself pretty deep into the polyethylene tail path. But it is definitely a fair way to try and look at it from a different angle.
I guess in looking at your little graphs, I can tell the green ones are probably A scale.
Yeah.
Was there any variation relative to the cleavage of
these guys?
Cleaved versus, what's being decayed versus what's not.
So, I haven't done that analysis. Okay. I do really want to do that because it would be a great way to try and say if these reeds en masse have shorter tails than these reeds. Everything besides, I guess, these super long ones that are kind of end of life mRNAs might point to an idea of deamylation being somehow a prerequisite to NMD cleavage, which is part of the model that I'm trying to test. I got really sucked into that whole poly A bias stuff over the past couple months, but I am really excited about this data set and I want to create a couple replicas of it and be able to actually dig into that. But it is really exciting. It is my biological question rather than some weird technical thing. On this one, the NMD eliciting stuff from this right here. I think I have a line for it somewhere. Yeah, so it's just a little bit downstream of this red line.
It's where the fat part is.
Yes, sorry. Be good enough that annotated.
I was trying to see if there's no cleavage site.
There is almost nothing there. Yeah, I agree. There's like three reads, but I think if I start relying on three reads out of a couple million, I'm going to be or a million or so, I'm going to be in a bad spot. I think that I don't have a strong enough knockdown of external one to be able to kind of speak to that yet. I think if I can really knock down exon 1 effectively and hopefully at the protein level as well, we talked about trying to do some Degron stuff to be able to knock that out quickly, I might be able to start seeing really where that cleavage happened rather than capturing kind of the downstream.
Exon 1 section?
Yeah, exon 1 is essential. Sorry, those people. I really appreciate all the feedback. Yes, I've been super excited about this. And I'm really happy to be able to share it with everyone. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you, Michael.